Hello, I'm Father Charles Connor from the Diocese of Scranton, Pennsylvania, and author of the book Classic Catholic Converts. We want to welcome you to this series on the Catholic priesthood through the ages, as today we consider the fathers of the Church on the priesthood. Please stay tuned. The fathers of the Church is an interesting and even an intriguing sort of title. Whenever we use it, we are usually referring to bishops and priests in the early Church whose sermons and whose teachings taken together constitute Orthodox Catholic doctrine. The term Fathers of the Church was first used by people like St. Basil the Great and St. Gregory Nazianzen, and when they used it, they were talking about the Council Fathers who gathered for the Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D. That was the council that gave us the Nicene Creed that we recite at Holy Mass every Sunday. Well, when people like Basil and Gregory were referring to the Council Fathers of Nicaea, they began calling them the Fathers of the Church, and the title stuck. It was used until the 8th century in the East, or I should more properly say the era of the Fathers of the Church came to a close in about the 8th century in the East, and even earlier than that, in the 7th century in the West. But their writings have given us a tremendous amount of knowledge on the nature of the priesthood. Their writings have helped to develop the Church's thought and meditation on the priestly office, on the sacrament of holy orders. Usually when scholars study the Fathers of the Church, they tend to divide them into two periods in the Church's history. The pre-Nicene Fathers, that would be earlier than 325 A.D., earlier than the Council of Nicaea, and the post-Nicene Fathers after 325 A.D., after the Council of Nicaea. So to try to concentrate our efforts on them in this episode, we naturally have to begin with the pre-Nicene Fathers of the Church, those who were writing earlier than the year 325 A.D., and we begin with an ancient bishop of Lyon, present-day city of Lyon in France, St. Irenaeus, who wrote a very famous work called Against the Heresies. In the book Against the Heresies, Irenaeus writes these words: "We ought to listen to those presbyters of the Church who have the succession from the apostles, who, with the succession of the episcopate, have, by the Father's good pleasure, received the infallible charism of truth." What did St. Irenaeus mean? We ought to listen to our bishops. Our bishops are the successors of the apostles. If we listen to our bishops as they proclaim the truth, we know they are proclaiming the truth of Christ. Everyone at the time of Irenaeus of Lyon was not listening to his or her bishop. That's where the problem was arising. Some heretics were coming on the scene and saying you did not have to listen to what the bishop had to say. You could form your own personal opinion. Irenaeus of Lyon said no. That was one of his purposes in writing his book Against the Heresies. As we move into the 3rd century, about 100 years after St. Irenaeus, we find that the 3rd century of the Church's life was more concerned with schism than it was with heresy. And the emphasis is placed much more on the liturgical and the pastoral function of the bishop, somewhat to the exclusion, not the total exclusion, but somewhat to the exclusion of his teaching office. You don't hear the teaching office emphasized as much in 3rd century Church literature. In many of our 3rd century sources, the bishop is described as the high priest. Well, that, of course, is his liturgical role. He is also described as the shepherd, and that is his pastoral role. And these are his roles in the local Church. We read that as high priest, the bishop baptizes and he confirms new Christians. He ordains new clerics, and he offers the holy gifts at the Eucharist, assisted, of course, by his clergy. As pastor, he unites the whole local Church to itself, uniting all of the members of the local Church in his own person. And he also unites his own local Church to other local churches around in the single communion of the worldwide Catholic Church. This, then, is the emphasis that we read and the emphasis which is placed on the office of bishop in the 3rd century. The idea was very well developed by St. Cyprian of Carthage in his work on the unity of the Church. In that book, St. Cyprian of Carthage sets forth what really would become the classic statement on the bishop's unitive role, exercised in pastoral love and sensitivity, but also in pastoral discipline vis-a-vis his own clergy and laity in his own diocese, in his own local church, but also exercised in relationship to other bishops in their local churches, so that all the bishops together, exercising their pastoral authority, were the unifiers of the church, and that unity of the church, St. Cyprian of Carthage, contrasted with the unity of the persons of the Most Blessed Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And Cyprian did this, made this comparison in a particularly beautiful way in his work on the unity of the church. Another third century source that we always have to turn to for our understanding of the development of holy orders is a priest writing in the third century by the name of Hippolytus. Hippolytus wrote a work called The Apostolic Tradition. Hippolytus harkens back to the earliest days of the church, and he discusses in detail some of the letters that were written by St. Ignatius of Antioch. In other words, Hippolytus brings Ignatius up to the third century and tries to explain what St. Ignatius of Antioch was trying to say in his very, very early letters. For Ignatius, the bishop is essentially the unifier of the local church, as celebrant of its mystical banquet in the Eucharistic assembly. In other words, what Ignatius of Antioch was doing was anticipating St. Cyprian's idea of the bishop as pastor and high priest. So we are seeing then in this pre-Nicene literature, this literature that came from church history earlier than 325 AD, we're seeing the gradual dawning of the consciousness that the bishops of the church had indeed inherited the apostolic ministry in its three essential dimensions, the priestly, the prophetic, and the pastoral offices. Now, at some points, you read the priestly office emphasized more. At other points in the literature, the pastoral office will be emphasized more. The emphasis then switches, if you will, from one writer to the next, and from one period of time to the next within this general framework of the third century. Now, what of the role of priests and deacons in the church, presbyters and deacons, by the third century? Well, to answer that question, we once again go to the writings of Hippolytus, the apostolic tradition. And we find that the priest's task, the presbyter's task, he's still largely called a presbyter in the third century, his tasks are mainly to govern and to teach. But he also does share in the liturgical functions of his bishop. The presbyter, we are told, will join in the imposition of hands, but he only joins in the imposition of hands with other presbyters. He will never join in the imposition of hands over a deacon. The presbyter joins the imposition of hands only over other presbyters, just as we have in the ceremony of priestly ordination today. In the ceremony of priestly ordination, the bishop is the first to impose hands, and then he is joined by all of his priests. But if you go to a diaconate ordination, you will see that the priests do not join in the imposition of hands over the deacons. So the roles are very, very clearly distinguishable, and they go to the third century of the church's life. We find this very clearly explained in the apostolic tradition of Hippolytus. It is very, very clearly pinpointed for us at this early date. Also, some 50 years later, when Cyprian of Carthage was writing, we find the presbyter in the writings of Cyprian of Carthage presiding at the Eucharist, either alone or with other presbyters. Now, what do we mean by presiding at the Eucharist with other presbyters? We mean simply the celebration of Holy Mass, as you and I would understand that today. As far as the deacon, as Hippolytus describes him in the apostolic tradition, the deacon is said to be ordained, quotes, not for priesthood, but for the service of the bishop. He does not receive the, again, quotes, common spirit of the presbyterium, but rather what is entrusted to him by the bishop's power. So it seems that the roles are very clearly distinguishable, but in the third century, there is one other interesting aspect if you examine all of the literature. If you zero in on the liturgical role, the very, very specific liturgical role of the bishop, the presbyter, and the deacon, sometimes you will find confusion in their liturgical roles as you examine the literature of the third century of the church's life. It is assumed that in the third century, if you had been living then, you would have known. In other words, bishops, priests, and deacons would have had a clear delineation of what was their role and function in the liturgical life of the church. But it's interesting in the period of the persecution of Diocletian, in the absence of presbyters, some deacons actually presided at the Holy Eucharist, and they were very, very seriously reprimanded by at least two early Western church councils for having done so. So that is an interesting point that comes to us from this pre-Nicene literature. In this period of time, the bishop derived his special liturgical functions in his own church from that particular ministry that was summed up in the figure of James. You recall that James is described as the Lord's brother in the Jerusalem church. James had the ministry of what was called the first presbyter, who would really be the natural choice when some minister was needed to give thanks at the Holy Eucharist, acting, of course, in the person of Christ the Lord at the Last Supper. The bishop's pastoral functions during these years were derived from his presidency over his local presbyterate, just as a bishop presides over his diocese today. It was something that was very clearly the part then of the bishop in this period of time. And finally, the factor which made the bishop quite unique in the third century was his very special responsibility for teaching Orthodox doctrine. We find that clearly expressed in the writings of St. Irenaeus, that it is the bishop's function to teach and to preserve the doctrinal orthodoxy of the church. And also, he is very uniquely the one who is to, by the imposition of hands, ordain presbyters. And you will find that clearly delineated in the writings of Hippolytus. So as we are now in the third century, the role of the bishop is very, very clearly expressed to us. And these particular roles that the bishop performed were inherited from the apostolic delegates who exercised precisely these same two functions at the close of the New Testament period. So, as a result then of this development of this apostolic succession, the office of the pre-Nicene priest was very quickly seen as a role that could be exercised only in collaboration with his bishop. The priest was the priest purely and simply because the bishop had ordained him a priest. The priest carried out the prophetic functions and the priestly functions and the kingly functions of Christ only in collaboration with his bishop, who was given this primary task as a presider over the local church. The roles then of bishop and priest became clearer and clearer as they became more distinct. They were sharers, of course, in the same priesthood of Christ, but their roles were very distinct, with the bishop having the fullness of priesthood, of course, and the presbyter being the collaborator, if you will, of the bishop in the local church. Clearly defined then in the pre-Nicene church, but foundations were laid for even further development, as one spiritual writer has noted, and we quote, "As the early liturgical sources present ordination, the sacramental laying on of hands so consecrates the bishop and presbyter that they are at a level which only the Holy Spirit can reach, suitably transformed. A new bond with the Son and the Spirit is forged, so that the candidate is empowered to act by their strength in that ministry to which his ordination deputes him. We have here the seeds of the doctrine of the priestly character, a doctrine which will play a major part in the theology of order in the centuries to come." Close quote. And we will be looking at that priestly character in much greater detail in a later episode. Well, now what about the development in the post-Nicene church in the years after 325 A.D.? Well, we find that bishops begin to exercise much more authority in church councils. We also find that presbyters or priests begin to exercise more authority, and the reason they do so is because the number of Christians, the number of Catholics, is growing and growing and growing. So, very shortly after the Council of Nicaea, you find that we have the development of what you and I today know as the parish priest. The parish priest was the liturgist, he was the teacher, and he was the pastor of a single congregation which was occasionally visited by the bishop. Well, today in the parish church, the bishop comes to administer the sacrament of confirmation as a rule, but the priest is the primary catechist and liturgist and teacher in the parish, the geographic confines of his own particular parish where he functions as pastor of the parish. So it's interesting how the bishop had more authority over councils, but the priest had more authority, it would appear, on the parish level. The terms seem to be switching now in the post-Nicene Church from presbyter to priest. By 360 A.D., we have the use of the term priest very, very clearly associated with what had been associated with presbyters earlier. And certainly by the 370s A.D., the 380s A.D., the term priest becomes normative in the very, very same way that you and I would understand the concept of the priest today. Not only did the term priest become normative, but we have the development now in the late 4th century and into the early 5th century of a very unique theology of the priesthood. It's interesting how the theology of the priesthood began to be developed. The theology of the priesthood actually began in a rather negative sort of way, and the first one to begin it was St. Augustine of Hippo. Remember that Augustine had been baptized in 387 A.D. in Milan by Ambrose. St. Augustine was very much concerned with a heresy in his younger day called the Donatist heresy. There had been a number of priests in the church who had lived through persecutions, and a number of these priests had, quote-unquote, handed over the books or handed over the scriptures, as the popular expression of those days went. In other words, priests oftentimes left the church and joined heretical sects purely and simply to avoid persecution and to avoid martyrdom. Well, after the persecutions ended, after the various heresies and so forth had diminished and things were, the living was easier, I suppose we can say, these priests wanted to return to the church, and many people said, no, you cannot, you're a schismatic, you left, your sacraments would not be valid, and so forth. And St. Augustine had to address himself very clearly to this issue, and this is what St. Augustine said. Augustine taught that there could be a genuine ordained ministry, and therefore a very true proclamation of the word and celebration of the sacraments, even if those who were officiating at them were in heresy. They had been validly ordained, he said. Therefore, their celebrations were valid, although they may not always be licit. And to this, he added another interesting note. He added that not all valid sacraments were fruitful sacraments. In other words, the fact of schism, the objectively sinful context of celebrating validly but illicitly, had some ramifications about it. And what were the ramifications? Well, St. Augustine said that the full grace of the particular sacrament could not be released to the recipient until such time as the one who presided at the sacrament had reconciled and had himself come back to the state of sanctifying grace. In other words, you and I could not receive the full benefit of the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist, let us say, if we were assisting at a Mass that had been offered by a priest who was in schism, who had left the church. That does not mean we were not getting grace, but we were not getting the fullness of grace. But we would ultimately, said Augustine, receive the fullness of grace when and if that minister who had been in schism, who had been in heresy, returned to full communion with the church. Well, in the very same era that Augustine was writing, St. Gregory Nazianzen was writing and developing a theology of the priesthood as well. He was concerned with giving an account of the duties of the ordained ministry, and he took his lead from St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, the whole idea of the priest as pastor and teacher, and this is what Gregory Nazianzen wrote. He called the priest a physician of souls, and he said, "The guiding of man, that most variable and manifold of creatures, seems to me in very deed to be the art of arts and the science of sciences. Anyone may recognize this by comparing the work of the physician of souls with the treatment of the body. And noticing that, laborious as the latter is, ours is more laborious and of more consequence from the nature of its subject matter, the power of its science, and the object of its exercise." This theme of teacher was taken up some years later by St. Ambrose of Milan in many of the conferences that he gave to his younger clergy. And following Ambrose of Milan, we have the magnificent work on the priesthood, which is written by St. John Chrysostom. Chrysostom was writing at roughly the same time as St. Ambrose was writing his works. And Chrysostom was leading a life of contemplation in the mountains near his native city of Antioch. St. John Chrysostom had a very exalted view of the pastoral office of the priest, and he referred to the encounter between Peter and Christ, and he tried to imagine what our Lord may have said to Peter, and this is what Chrysostom wrote. "If you love me, practice fasting, sleep on the ground, prolong your vigils, defend the oppressed, be a father to the orphans, a husband to the widow that bore them." But passing over all these things, what does he say? "Shepherd my sheep." John Chrysostom gave much more attention than either Gregory Nazianzen or Ambrose to the liturgical functions of the priest. Because of the holiness of the Eucharist which the priest celebrates, he said that the New Testament ministerial priest exercises a much more august office than his Old Testament predecessors ever did. "For in the Eucharistic sacrifice, the Lord himself lies immolated on the altar, while in the prayer for the people, the priest calls down not fire from heaven like Elijah the prophet of old, the priest actually calls down the Holy Spirit himself." Again, to quote John Chrysostom, "Though the office of the priesthood is exercised on earth, it ranks nevertheless in the order of celestial things, and rightly so. It was neither man, nor an angel, nor an archangel, nor any other created power, but the Paraclete himself who established this ministry and who ordained that men abiding in the flesh should imitate the mystery of the angels. For that reason," says Chrysostom, "it behooves the bearer of the priesthood to be as pure as if he stood in the very heavens amidst those powers." It's very difficult to capture the beauty of John Chrysostom's writings on the priesthood anywhere else but in his own writings themselves. He had borrowed a great deal of thought from the church's early monastic tradition, but Chrysostom also combined that monastic tradition with practical, everyday common sense for the active priest who was out in the world. He said that the priest should be a man who is sober, who's vigilant, ascetical, a man of very, very deep prayer. It was important that he be a man who controlled his temper very well because he dealt with so many different kinds of people, a man who knew his theology well because he had to refute many, many heretics and many pagans. He was also a man who had to be knowledgeable just to be able to answer the questions of so many of those of his own flock about so many matters of their own faith. And finally, said John Chrysostom, a priest is a man who was meant to be an intercessor, one who draws near to God by interceding for both the living and the dead. Pope Gregory the Great was yet another contributor to the priestly literature of the post-Nicene Church in writing his very, very famous pastoral rule. Pope Gregory the Great tried to give the secular clergy, again, a counterpart to Benedict's monastic rule for the life in monasteries. Gregory sought to create a pastorally inclined clergy, men who were trained in preaching and in teaching. Interestingly, Gregory's work was translated into Greek for use in the Byzantine Empire, and it was brought to England by St. Augustine of Canterbury and the early monks who went to Christianize the British Empire. In the Empire of Charlemagne, Gregory's teaching was presented to every new bishop at his consecration. And he tried to emphasize, Pope Gregory did, dealing in the most effective manner possible with every individual and with every group, and trying to give them the essentials of the moral life. He said that a pastor should unite the contemplative and active lives together in his person. He should not neglect his own inner life by preoccupying himself with a lot of external activities, nor for that matter, failing to give attention to external activities by doing nothing but praying all day. Isn't it interesting? Finally, the post-Nicene Church was well known for its development of the beautiful teaching on celibacy. Much of the early Western legislation on the topic of clerical continence or celibacy seems to focus on this idea of clerical continence as specifically applied to married clergy. We know that many priests, many deacons, many bishops were married men. We know that Peter, at least of the apostles, was a married man. And so therefore the emphasis was the discipline of abstinence from marital relations on the part of those clergy who were already married. if a bishop, if a priest or a deacon was prohibited from having relations once in orders, having relations with his wife once in orders, then it is clear, it certainly is clear that his commitment to continence would be the major impediment, obviously, to any subsequent marriage. Well, very, very strong testimonies are found in the post-Nicene Church defending clerical continence or celibacy by such writers as Ambrose, Augustine, St. Jerome. And the first known example of legislation came in 305 at the Council of Elvira in Spain. And this is what the council said. We decree that all bishops, priests, and deacons in service of the ministry are entirely forbidden to have conjugal relations with their wives and to beget children. Should anyone do so, the council said, let him be excluded from the honor of the clergy. Now, why was it? What was the underlying motivating factor or factors in the post-Nicene Church? There was a spirituality of celibacy that had already developed. For a man to be a man of deeper prayer, he needed to be continent or celibate. For a man to be one totally devoted to his people, he needed to be a celibate man. A further argument developed by St. Ambrose and others was a refutation of many of those people who looked to the Old Testament Levitical priesthood. You know, there was an emphasis in the Old Testament among the Levitical priests of only being celibate for short periods of time when they were performing their priestly functions. And St. Ambrose and others said, listen, the Old Testament Levitical priesthood was one thing. The Christian priesthood in which a man is uniquely configured to Jesus Christ, the eternal high priest, is quite another. One does not exercise the Christian priesthood on a temporary basis. One is not engaged in an occupation. One has been called to an absolute life of service, a life of service in imitation of him who was the eternal high priest, him who was a celibate man himself. Therefore, the two are not to be compared, said St. Augustine, or rather St. Ambrose. Celibacy is something which must be part and parcel of the Christian priest's life. He must make it his own, and to the extent that he does, he will become a more spiritual man. He will become a holier man. He will become a more dedicated priest. There are the beginnings and the origins. And we move next to the medieval period, the great era of faith, and a further development of the priesthood.
Join Father Charles Connor next week at this time to find out more about the Catholic priesthood through the ages here on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.